Spending habits, good or bad, have to come from somewhere, right? Well, what if I told you that the language you speak might be a factor? John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. My first guest this hour has just published a study that links language and, among other things, spending habits. Later in the hour, we'll talk with a language educator from Wisconsin about the importance of early foreign language education and the challenges those programs face in an era of tight budgets. First, I'd like to welcome behavioral economist Keith Chen, Associate Professor of Economics at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. Professor Chen, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
It's wonderful to be here.
Well, first of all, satisfy my curiosity on one point. What is a behavioral economist?
Sure. So a behavioral economist is, well, first and foremost, an economist, but an economist who tries to take seriously the fact that we don't always live up to the better angels of our own nature. We are psychological creatures. We're driven by emotion and impulse sometimes in our decision making, and then a behavioral economist tries to think about what effects that has on our decision making and what those kinds of decisions that we might make, how those impact our aggregate economy.
Okay, and you also study something called intertemporal decision making. Illuminate us on that score, will you please?
That's a fancy word for something that we're all very familiar with. So intertemporal just means across time, and it basically means that what I study is choices that we make, where the choices that we make today have long-ranging impacts on how we do in the future. So think about exercising. It's kind of painful today. I have to wake up at 6 in the morning to get out and run. And those benefits mainly accrue in the future, right? I feel better later that day, but I also am not, don't have quite as thick of a gut later that year.
Mm-hmm. So taking those things into consideration then, what is it that put you on to the idea of some sort of relationship between language and decisions we make about the future or spending habits or the like?
Yeah, well, so one way of thinking about this is that a lot of the decisions we make, for example, how much we're going to save out of our current income for retirement later, those are really, really difficult decisions. I mean, if you ask an economist to just like grind through the math to figure out how much you should be saving for retirement, actually, it's an incredibly difficult decision to make, even if you have a PhD in the subject. So how is it that people do this, or how is it that we are able to kind of force ourselves to exercise, to kind of eat less than we would like to at a current moment, or do all kinds of things that have benefits in the future? One of the interesting things is that the psychology of this has been shown to be very, very difficult and elusive. And what I started to realize, or what I started to become interested in my research, was the degree to which subtle kind of psychological cues can affect that decision making, can affect how much we empathize with our future selves and are capable of making decisions, not just for our own kind of current best interests, but for our future best interests. And one of the things that I've been studying a lot in my current research is the degree to which the way that our language structures time, or in some sense, the way that our language encourages us to speak about time, can actually have a subtle impact on how we think about time. In some sense, a habit of speech translating into a habit of thought. What I've been doing a lot in my recent research is looking at whether or not differences across languages, the ways that different languages encode time, whether or not that can have subtle effects on how people save for retirement, how people are able to resist smoking, how people are capable of exercising.
And can you give some examples of where that's the case?
So, what's actually quite remarkable is that it's very difficult to find a forward-looking behavior in which this isn't the case. Let me tell you a little bit about how languages might differ on this dimension first. So, for example, all forms of Chinese, from Mandarin Chinese to Cantonese Chinese, are examples of what linguists call futureless languages, or weak FTR language, weak future time reference languages. And what effectively that means is that when a Chinese speaker is thinking about or speaking about a future event, he talks about it in a very similar way that he talks about a current event. effectively in Chinese, you can say something that to an English speaker would sound very, very strange. You can say, tomorrow rain it, and not have to modify the verb, not have to encode in your grammar the fact that you're talking about a future event. Or if you're talking with a friend and they ask you, would you like to go see a movie tonight? You can say, I'm sorry, I eat with uncle, or I have dinner plan. It's a perfectly natural way of speaking. And in some sense, it puts the future and the present on an equal grammatical footing. This isn't just a feature of languages that are far related from English, say, for example, Chinese. But, for example, in Europe, Finnish and Estonian are both futureless languages. And actually, English is a bit of an outlier. Within Europe, at least, English is the only Germanic language that really, really forces you to constantly embed in your grammar the fact that a future event is something different than a present event. So, for example, if you speak with German speakers, they're very comfortable saying, morgen regnet es, or morgen ist es kalt, both literally translating to tomorrow rain it, or tomorrow it cold. What's interesting is that you see, if you look both across countries, what you see is that countries whose languages, in some sense, put the future and present on equal grammatical footing actually seem to encourage much more future-oriented behavior. So, countries on average save about 5% more of their GDP per year if their languages equate the future and the present. And households in those countries save dramatically more as well. They're 30% more likely to save in any given year, even after controlling for religion, income, family structure, age, marital structure, religion, all of these different factors. On average, they retire with 25% more in savings. And across a wide swath of countries, are, for example, 20% less likely to smoke. You could think about smoking as negative savings. If savings is current pain for future pleasure, smoking is current pleasure for future pain. So you'd expect the opposite result, and you see it. Languages that equate the future and the present are have families that are 13 to 17% less likely to be obese. And in areas with, for example, high ambient HIV rates, families or individuals whose languages equate the future and the present are 21% more likely to use condoms. And this holds in basically every major region of the world, and even within countries in which there are multiple native languages, some of which are futureless and some of which are futured.
So you're able to observe facts about what happens in places where there are, as you say, futureless languages. Do you have you been able to gain some understanding of why that is, what the specific psychological relationship is between a futureless language and this ability to think more in terms of sacrificing something today for a benefit tomorrow?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways of trying to narrow in on exactly that question, like what is the exact psychological mechanism. Some of that can come through how people use language in more broad settings. So, for example, oftentimes you see tense shifting strategies in language that give a little bit of a clue of what's going on. So, for example, in English, if I say something like, if I had a car, I'd give you a ride, I'm not talking about not having a car in the past. I'm talking about not having a car in the present, but I'm using the past tense. If I had a car, I'd give you a ride. And why am I doing that? Well, by shifting the way that I speak away from the present and into, in this instance, the past, I'm indicating to you that that this thing is distant. I have a car, I had a car, and I'm saying that I don't have a car, so in some sense, this is distant from current reality. How do I know that I'm using the past tense, but I don't mean to signal kind of pastness? Well, if I wanted to signal pastness, I would have to double down on the past tense. I'd have to say, if I had a car when I was a student, I would have been much more popular, something like that. So you can see clues to how this operates psychologically, both in how people use language and also using more standard social science kind of techniques, for example, survey data. So interestingly, even if you zoom in on kind of families, say like two Belgian families, one of which speaks Flemish and one of which speaks French, even if you only compare families that are basically virtually identical, so the head of households are the same age, they have the same number of children, the same social structure, they have the same income, they attend the same church. The family that speaks Flemish, which is a futureless language, saves more than the family that speaks French. But, for example, when asked in survey questions, does not express that saving for the future is more important of a cultural value. So what's interesting is that this linguistic feature seems to be this kind of subtle nudge that occurs every time we speak, or at least most consistent with the data. It doesn't seem as if kind of speaking about the future and the present differently makes you value the future any less. It just seems that it just subtly makes it seem a little bit more distant.
Interesting. I'd like to see if our listeners want to get in on this conversation. I'm sure that people will have some questions. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. What language you speak can affect your behavior. We're talking about that this hour, specifically how it affects the way you look at money, at finances. That's one aspect of this. There are others. And what does it mean to have a futureless language? 800-642-1234. My guest is behavioral economist Keith Chan, associate professor of economics at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. Coming up, but we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, Professor, I'd like to talk about whether or not learning a new language would make me think differently about finance. So, for example, if I embarked on a course of study in Cantonese or Flemish or Finnish or some other futureless language, how long would that take before it would affect me? In terms of my behavior, I'd like to know if you made any determinations in that direction. And hopefully we'll have some calls. I see some people are already lining up. So we'll take some calls for Professor Chen as well. 800-642-1234. Plenty of room for you to get in on the discussion. Talk at WPR.org also works. And you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page and reach out to us that way as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, when is lecturing a good idea and when is it not? Rob Ferret and Gene Purcell will explore that idea today on Central Time from 3 to 6. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about a study which suggests that the language you speak, and particularly how that language speaks about the future or doesn't, affects how you handle money, among other things. My guest is behavioral economist Keith Chan, associate professor of economics at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. And also later in the hour, we're going to be talking about the importance of learning a language other than the one that you normally speak in life in general. So we'll talk about that a little bit later this hour. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Professor Chen, before the break, I suggested maybe if I learned a new language, that would help me be a better saver. Would I, if I suddenly became a Flemish speaker, which seems more likely to me than my trying to learn Cantonese, for example, would that turn me into a more thrifty person?
Well, you know, so we don't actually have very, very good evidence on how quickly kind of learning a new language can help you. Or fundamentally changes the kind of cognitive structure of how you kind of categorize and think about the world. We do have a lot of evidence on bilinguals, and there is a lot of interesting and exciting research in the cognitive psychology world that shows that bilinguals oftentimes kind of seem in between kind of speakers of the individual languages that they speak with respect to this. So, for example, there's this very, very rich literature on color perception that finds that bilinguals look very, very similar and it can be cued to look like one language or the other, or when uncued, kind of look in between the two languages that they speak. So, for example, much like time is a continuum, and how our language breaks it up can differ from language to language, the color spectrum is inherently kind of a continuous phenomena that our language tends to discretize and break up into different pieces. There's this fascinating body of research in cognitive psychology that looks at, well, for example, where does your language break between the words red and orange? Does that vary between languages? Or even more fundamentally, like how many different basic color terms does your language have? So, for example, the Japanese language didn't have separate words for blue and green before contact with the West. The Chinese language has, even though the English language has about 11 different basic color terms, so you could think about if I just showed you kind of a swath of color, an English speaker would naturally kind of break that into one of 11 different categories, so red, yellow, green, orange, you get the idea. There are 11 different categories in English. There's actually only about 6, for example, in Chinese. And Chinese lacks many kind of basic color terms that kind of forces Chinese speakers to speak analogically about colors that an English speaker would find quite natural. So, for example, when describing something that an English speaker would naturally say is brown, a Chinese speaker often has to speak analogically and say that's coffee-colored or that's kind of earth-colored. Now, how does that affect your cognition? Is this just a different way of speaking, or is this also a different way of thinking? Well, interestingly, there are two languages we know of that actually have more fine color distinctions than English. So, for example, Russian marks an obligatory break between light blue, goliboy, and kind of dark blue, sine. And there's been a whole host of experiments that show that, for example, Russian speakers are much quicker at categorizing two swatches of blue as different from each other. I just show you kind of, for example, three kind of color swatches, and I just ask you as quickly as you can, tell me which two of these three are the match to each other and which one is the kind of odd blue out. Interestingly, Russian speakers are faster at this than English speakers, but only if the two swatches of blue break the goliboy-sine border, and are not any faster than English speakers if both blues are goliboy or if both blues are sine. And then interestingly to your question, bilinguals actually look in between. So bilinguals kind of seem they're faster than English speakers, but they're slower than kind of monolingual Russian speakers on this task.
Interesting.
We're getting some phone calls, and I want to make sure that people get a chance to ask a question here. Let's Sarah in Zion, Illinois, is going to ask the question that was next on my list. Sarah, go ahead.
Okay. Hey, great. Thanks, John. I agree that I can see how speaking a certain language will influence a person's behavior and personality, but I also think it must be true that a people's behavior and personality influences how that language is shaped, because they're creating the language. So maybe
Definitely.
These Chinese people already just didn't think about the future, and that's why they have a futureless language.
So there's kind of a chicken and egg argument here, I think.
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, it's almost impossible to think that that the nature or the culture of a particular people's or region shapes the language that those people speak. I mean, what is language but on some dimensions kind of a reflection of how we think? Interestingly, though, there are ways to try and get at this chicken and egg problem. So, for example, one way of thinking about it is that something that changes very quickly in a language are kind of what linguists call lexical dimensions. So do we have words for different concepts? What's slower to change is the fundamental grammatical structure. So, for example, English, like I said earlier, English is different than every other Germanic language in Europe in insisting that we kind of break future events from present events in our grammar. We have to say we will run, or it will rain, or it's going to rain. We can't just kind of say it rained tomorrow, or tomorrow it cold, like most other Germanic speakers can. That difference actually emerged between Old English and Middle English. That's a very, very old difference. So in some sense, if it is kind of a very old cultural feature that's at work here, it's a very, very old one. So in some sense, you can kind of look at more kind of recent savings behavior and kind of at the very least know that this behavior isn't immediately causing a feedback into the language structure, because this language structure, at least these grammatical differences, are thousands of years old.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Fred in Madison next. Fred, good afternoon.
Hi. I think it's a very interesting discussion. Now, what about what is called in English the present progressive, like I'm going to school at 3 o'clock? In terms of logic, strictly, it's future. Or if I say, I'm seeing you tonight at 8, that grammatically, it is present progressive, but logically it's future. But the ING form, is not, strictly speaking, a present tense. It's a continuous tense. So it extends, it pushes into the future. And I want to ask you one other thing, and I did study languages. Aren't you giving us what is called the Whorf hypothesis, that a person's language kind of types them or stamps them with a character? Okay.
Definitely. Definitely. So I think the caller brings up two really, really interesting points. The first is that what I'm speaking about in my study is something that linguists call future time reference. And the basic question here is whether or not future events and present events have to be, in some sense, kind of grammatically marked differently, and then, you know, going further, whether or not that then influences whether they're cognitively processed differently. But what the speaker points out is two interesting things. First of all, how we kind of encode time in our language is actually incredibly complex. So there's what linguists call aspect, kind of like, is this an ongoing kind of event? Like, do we find ourselves in the midst of a temporal event? Also, to the speaker's point, there are exceptions in English. So, for example, even more sharp examples in English than what the speaker brought up. But for example, in English, if an event is pre-scheduled, it seems perfectly natural sometimes to speak about it even in the simple present tense. So, for example, the train leaves at 6. You know, I'm clearly talking about a future departure, but I just use the simple present, leaves. These tendencies, though, linguists can classify as in some sense a continuum. Like, how far out on this dimension are languages? Does a language require? Are there just very, very narrow instances in which we can talk about kind of a pre-scheduled event that occurs in the future and the present, or do we have to really, really mark very, very carefully when exactly an event that we're thinking about or speaking about is going to happen? And when you look at these more continuous measures, which can be coded either through kind of carefully examining the grammar or by examining just how native speakers of those languages speak, you find actually a continual effect that in some sense the more your language breaks the future from the present, the harder it appears to be to kind of engage in future-oriented behaviors. Interestingly, there are many languages on the planet that have multiple temporally distinct future events, future categories. So, for example, a very common feature of language is a hadernal future tense, like, you know, the present progressive, I am running, an immediate future, something that's not happening right now, but something that will happen momentarily. And then a hadernal future, something that's not happening now, that's not about to start happening, but that will happen before the sun rises tomorrow. And then a totally different way about speaking about the far future. Whereas when you keep cutting the data into finer and finer units, it becomes harder to kind of pick out precise effects. It does appear that the more finely your language even divides the present and the future, the more, in some sense, the more distinct categories you put between the kind of the you of the now, the you of today, and the you of your retirement, the harder it is to save for that future.
So a couple of quick questions as we close this segment. What is the what's the overall takeaway from what you've found out so far? And then what questions does this research suggest that you want to look into further?
Sure. So, you know, I think this research and also some of the kind of more experimental cognitive psychology research, for example, with the blues that I was telling you about earlier, suggests that, you know, that the basic structure of your language can have this subtle ability to kind of nudge the way that you think. Think of it as kind of an attention nudge, that if your language kind of forces you to pay attention to distinctions in the world that another language doesn't, it kind of makes you kind of make decisions based on that or notice things that you might not otherwise have noticed. Some of the takeaways. So I'm not. I'm often asked this, and I'm not advocating, for example, that English, that the United States stops speaking English and starts to speak either Finnish or German, or that everybody learn kind of Estonian. You do see, though, that for example, a lot of advice that people give when making, for example, lists of your goals. It's very common advice to kind of state those goals in the present tense as opposed to the future tense. And you also see much more kind of radical experiments. For example, right now Sweden is spending quite a bit of money to try and eliminate gendered pronouns from their language, ostensibly in order to eliminate gender discrimination in their society. I think the research isn't quite to the point where we can kind of definitively conclude that those types of linguistic interventions will have long-term effects. But I think it's an interesting and open question.
Mm-hmm. And what usually research when you answer one set of questions, it opens you up to a new set. What questions or what one or two questions are you still looking to answer related to this topic?
Well, so I've started working with a bunch of colleagues at kind of experimental work at either kind of teaching people kind of artificial languages. For example, imagine one artificial language that has a richly constructed future tense and another artificial language that has a richly constructed past tense, and looking at whether or not that has differences, whether or not we can quickly induce differences in behavior depending upon which of these two kind of artificial languages you have to play in a video game, for example. I also have some new work on whether or not the way that your language structures or asks you to kind of take other people's perspective versus your perspective in speaking, whether or not that can subtly affect empathy and the ability to quickly and naturally put yourself in other people's shoes in, for example, strategic situations. So I think there's a tremendous amount of kind of we're really only kind of viewing the tip of the iceberg here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really appreciate your time with us this afternoon, and fascinating topic. And I hope to hear more as your research progresses. This is very interesting.
Thank you, John. I've had a tremendous amount of fun speaking with you.
Keith Chen is Associate Professor of Economics at the UCLA Anderson School of Management. And thanks to Cynthia Schuster for booking Professor Chen for us this afternoon. We're going to make a shift here in topic for the show. And we've been talking about how your language can affect the way you think and the way you behave. And we're going to kind of move now to language learning and how important it is, particularly learning a language that may not be yours to begin with, not the one you were born with, for example. I hate to use the term foreign language because that sounds so exclusionary, but we'll probably end up having to use that anyway because that's the shorthand most of us use for languages that are not English. Right or wrong. I'd like to welcome to the Kathleen Dunn program Lynn Neitzel, Director of Curriculum and Assessment at Black Hawk Technical College. a certified K-12 teacher of Japanese and past president of the Wisconsin Association of Foreign Language Teachers. Lynn Neitzel, welcome to the Kathleen Dunn Show.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, we've been learning about the importance of language in terms of how it helps us see the world and helps form our behaviors, including things like spending habits and ways we look at the future. I think we'd all agree language is important in terms of education, but for most people in this country, it stops at trying to get a good grasp of English, which many of us still struggle with. How important is it that people, particularly young people, learn more than one language?
Well, I think over my past years, and I've been fortunate to have been teaching in the actual K-5 setting in a K-12 program for over 20 years in Wisconsin, and have seen a change in our society. And I think when I first started teaching and learning language myself, it was about travel and going somewhere else to use that language. And that shift has changed in the last 20 years, whereas the world is really not across an ocean anymore. It's right down the street. And we need to be able to talk to our neighbors, whether they're on another continent or right next door, and to be able to work together. And we need to develop, I think, in our students, not just a sense of being able to use another language, but be able to react and respond to what's happening around them in an appropriate way.
Well, in the age of the internet, on another continent and right next door are virtually the same thing. I mean, you could be engaging someone in a Skype conversation who is 10,000 miles away from you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and especially if you're willing to get up in the middle of the night, you can do that often. And I think that's really, you know, quite the engaging part of learning languages. It's not probably like, and I'm making the assumption, when you and I learned language, we watched our teacher conjugate verbs on a board, and you learned how to conjugate all those verbs. Now it's actually using language in real time from a very beginning point of your language learning experience, which is very exciting and very intriguing, I think, to a lot of Americans, where, like I had said before, unless you were going to be traveling overseas, either for your own pleasure or for work, you didn't really see that purpose, and now the world is coming right to you, right in front of you on your computer screen.
So when it comes to learning a different language, how early is early enough?
Day one, when they're born, would be great if we could do that for all of our students. You know, if we can get students in preschool or kindergarten, first grade, a lot of the research says that by age 10, that window closes, that window of opportunity in your brain to be able to be very flexible with your language ability. And, it, you know, a lot of people have asked me, you know, what's the best language to learn, your second language, or what is the easiest language to learn? You know, all languages are easy in one way and all languages are difficult in, you know, some respect. And it depends on what your native language is. You know, to English speakers, Spanish and French and Italian tend to be a little bit easier to learn than possibly a language like Japanese or Chinese. But to a native Japanese speaker, Chinese is a little bit easier to learn for them, if that makes sense. But, you know, anything you want to do well takes a lot of practice. There's a reason that we make our students in the public schools study English and math every single year that they're in school. And there is no magic formula for learning another language. It just takes time. So the earlier, the better.
We usually use the term foreign language to describe languages other than English. Is that appropriate?
We're trying to change that vernacular in the world of foreign language teachers. We really refer to it as world language now, as opposed to foreign language, because like you had said in your introduction, it's foreign kind of has a negative connotation to it. So, yeah, children should start learning world languages when they're early, when they're young. It doesn't really matter, you know, which language it is. It would be great if we could actually produce a society of good language learners, because I would venture to say that professional athletes, professional football players, are probably really good athletes, period. They could pick up a golf club, they could pick up a baseball bat, they could learn how to play just about any sport really quickly, but they're really good at football. And if you think about that with world languages, when you learn how to be a language learner, you may speak one language fluently, but you're going to pick up other languages really quickly.
800-642-1234 is the number to call to join our discussion, Language on Our Minds This Hour, on the Kathleen Dunn Program. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, and the Kathleen Dunn Show is on Facebook. You can leave a comment or a question there. In this part of the program, my guest is Lynn Neitzel, Director of Curriculum and Assessment at Black Hawk Technical College, past president of the Wisconsin Association of Foreign Language Teachers. We're talking about the importance of learning another language and what it could mean. And when we come back, we've talked about, you know, how early we should start teaching that. But there have been a lot of changes and some challenges facing language educators in the state of Wisconsin, not just in the state of Wisconsin, but across the country in the era of austerity and budget cutting. And we'll touch on that as well. And we'll take your calls as well at 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on The Kathleen Dunn Show. My guest in this portion of the program is Lynn Neitzel, Director of Curriculum and Assessment at Black Hawk Technical College and past president of the Wisconsin Association of Foreign Language Teachers. We're talking about teaching language. Well, when I was in elementary school, and just to be clear, we did have electricity in those days. When I was in elementary school in the third grade, way back in a year we won't mention, the Hayward school system, which is where I was at the time, already had French as part of the elementary school curriculum. Now, I don't know if they still do or not in that district, but I think that wasn't all that uncommon to start language training that early. Is that still happening across the state? And what is the state of language education in Wisconsin right now?
Well, I think unfortunately, with the budgets that all public schools and private schools as well have been struggling with, world languages is looked at as an extra, and elementary school world languages is even looked at as like a double extra. So unfortunately, we've seen a lot of elementary world language programs cut, especially when it comes to languages other than Spanish. So it is part of the Department of Public Instruction's rules, for lack of a better word, that you do need to offer world language to seventh grade students and beyond. It doesn't really say how often or how much or which language, but you do have to have some type of world language offering in your school district from 7th through 12th grade. I know that the Wisconsin eSchool Network and the Wisconsin Virtual Schools have done a wonderful job of helping some of our outlying districts in some of our more obscure areas to be able to have those offerings for those students via the Internet.
Mm-hmm. We have some callers who want to join us, and let's go to the phones right now. John in Richland Center, you'll be first. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My grandfather was a professor from Heidelberg University. He could speak seven languages fluently. He taught me how to speak German when I was a child, and then I learned French in high school. So I'm trilingual.
And do you still use those languages?
Oh, yeah. Eins, zwei, drei, vier, fünf. Parlez-vous français?
Well, wie geht's and ça va, then. I'll just throw those. That's the extent of my knowledge of those two languages. What do you think was the benefit to you of learning those other languages?
Well, it's nice to learn new things.
Mm-hmm. Lynn Neitzel?
Yes. You know, I think sometimes we don't realize when you are learning another language, you really have to think about your own because your mind is making those comparisons. So we often hear the argument that, oh, if we offer world languages in elementary school, we're going to be taking away from time that they're going to be learning the English language, which is really not a truthful statement because the students are actually constantly doing some higher level thinking to be able to make those comparisons back and forth, why they're different, why they are similar. So, like our guest just said, you know, it's great to learn new things. You look at it in a different perspective, but you also learn a lot about your own language and your own culture and your own way of thinking.
I had an email from Gary in Minong who I think speaks to this point. He said, I didn't really learn about English grammar until I studied German. And I think
that's... Oh, go ahead.
Well, I think a lot of people would probably have that same perspective, that they really started to learn how to take their own language apart when they tried to learn another one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, every once in a while, I'll be sitting around with my family. There'll be a trivia show or something on, and they'll ask a grammar question, and I answer it right away, for lack of a better example. And they're all like, oh, you're such a language nerd. But it's true. You do really understand different parts of language, how language fits together, you know, how you learn the grammar, which is very important. I still think students need to learn the grammar of their own language.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, Julie in West Lima. Julie, good afternoon.
Hello there. I'm glad that I could speak with you today. I have a lot of friends that are Native Americans, and they often say that they think their language is the native language and English is the foreign language. And I also find it interesting that your guest teaches at the Black Hawk Technical College, and there were two Black Hawks, a Ho-Chunk, a Sac, and a Fox, and those are three different languages that were native to Wisconsin. And when she talks about teaching languages to the children, why aren't we teaching the native languages of the 11 tribes of Wisconsin to the children of Wisconsin? Because those were the original languages, not English, not any of these other languages at all. And that's my comment. I'll take your comment up here.
Julie, thanks so much for that call. Lynn Neitzel?
Yeah, actually, there is a huge initiative right now at the Department of Public Instruction. They're working on reviving and making sure that those Native American languages that are native to the state of Wisconsin are being revived and that are not being lost. They're working with an institute through the National through National Geographic called the Living Tongue Institute. And what that does is there is a group of cognitive scientists that speak many languages, and they go around and they document languages that have few speakers that are under the age of 50 years old, because they don't want these languages to die. And what they're really saying and what really makes sense is people don't understand that when a language dies, there's a lot of science and knowledge that goes away with it that we can never, ever know again without having that language. The way that people looked at the world and how they did scientific discovery and, you know, in the areas that they were in, that if you don't have a language, if you don't have a way to express those meanings, that knowledge is gone and lost forever. So, you know, the Oneida tribe up in the Green Bay area has done a wonderful job of really putting in a good, solid K-12 Oneida language learning program that I think is being copied now by several of the tribes in the state of Wisconsin. So I think you're going to see that come about here in the next couple of years.
And we started the hour with Professor Chen talking about the relationship between language and behavior and culture. And so, you know, this is pretty crucial that what you're talking about here, there really is this language is part of who we are as human beings. Let's go to Stacy in Fond du Lac next. Stacy, good afternoon.
Hello. My question has to do with teaching my own children Spanish. I am bilingual, but Spanish is my second language, and I'm concerned about my ability, I guess, to pass on the language accurately, and if there'd be any downsides to me being a non-native speaker of a language, choosing to teach my children the language.
Lynn Neitzel, what about Stacy's question about how to raise a child bilingually?
Oh, Stacy, good for you. Do it. Just do it. I've met a lot of people, have a lot of friends who their second languages are Spanish or other languages, and they are teaching their children. It takes a lot of time and it takes a lot of effort, but if you're willing to do it, you know, anything that you can give your children in the way of giving them another language is a gift. You know, don't worry if they don't come out fluent or bilingual like you are, but you're going to spark their interest. They're going to start looking at the world in a different way. Once they start learning a little bit more Spanish, they're going to be able to look at different cultures of Spanish, and something is going to intrigue them. If you're very interested, you can do a little Google search and take a look, you know, just Google how to raise your children bilingually, and there'll be a lot of resources for you to be able to tap into. There's also a network called the National Network for Early Language Learning. They have quite a few resources for parents that want to raise their children bilingually.
Thanks so much for that call. Michelle in Kenosha, you're next. Michelle, good afternoon. Thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon. Your guest is just so fantastic. I would love to hear a lot more programs about this, particularly because here in Kenosha, the public school district has had, we're in our 16th or 17th year of a Spanish-English dual language program that does start in kindergarten, and all three of my kids have gone through it, and all three are bilingual. And I guess I just wanted to say, and maybe your guest addressed this earlier, but there is really no end point in that language acquisition. So a lot of people are confused thinking, okay, yeah, there's an end point and we're going to get to this place. And I've had people even say, well, native Spanish speakers, they don't need to be in the dual language program because they already know how to speak Spanish. And I'm like, yeah, that's at a five-year-old's language ability. Why wouldn't they want to improve that as well? As you said earlier, we send our kids and learn English every year, and we don't say, okay, yeah, you're done at, you know, age 10 or something. So maybe if you could address that, and also some of the sort of strange, I don't know, resentment or difficulties that some of these advanced kids coming out of dual language have had with their high school teachers. It does seem as if the teachers are a little bit intimidated by their language abilities, and not quite sure how to address that as a parent and talking to their parents. So anyway, if you want to learn, I'd say to that other parent, look for dual language programs in your area, and maybe you can do it through open enrollment in another community. Thank you so much.
Michelle, thanks so much for that call. Lynn Neitzel, what about dual education programs?
Yeah, I do think the guest that was just on made a very good point. If you are looking for a dual language program, then, you know, that may be a competition between public schools, and it may make your school district really stick out. I do think that, yes, that we have a lot of teachers in our state that have been traditionally trained, although I would have to say that Wisconsin, as I've traveled around and gone to a lot of conferences in our nation and even internationally, we're very fortunate to have people in our state that have trained our world language teachers to be on the cutting edge. And I feel that these dual immersion or bilingual programs, these students that are coming from kindergarten, maybe through middle school and then getting into high school, and we struggled with this in our own district as well. The issue is we aren't teaching them Spanish 1 when they're in first grade and traditional Spanish 2 when they're in second grade. These students are coming with different types of skills, and we really need to look at a more performance-based type of a language skill. You know, what can do the students know, and what are they able to do in the language? And from there, we need to place them into levels that they need to be in high school so that they can continue to refine their language. And as your last guest just said, she made a perfect point. Language learning is never done. You're never done. So it's just making sure that our students get to the right level so they can continue to grow in their language and their cultural knowledge as well.
We only have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to ask, where are the language teachers going to come from? We certainly have seen some erosion in language instruction thanks to some budget cuts and shifting priorities. Where's the next batch of language teachers going to come from?
I know it's a huge struggle, and right now, and this might even be fading a little. Chinese is very popular, you know, to put in your school district. But finding good qualified candidates to be able to teach languages like Chinese and Japanese and Korean is very difficult, and especially in the Midwest when we do not have large heritage population of, you know, those type of speakers. So I think working with the universities very closely to make sure that our teachers, you know, have a good grasp of the language, plus the American school system, whether they grew up here or not, you know, they need to understand that how to teach American kids and how to work, you know, in this type of society. So that will be a struggle, and it will be a struggle to find language teachers in all languages. You know, a lot of programs that I've worked with that want to implement a new K-12 world language program, you know, will say, I want to put in Spanish because that's easiest to find teachers. Well, it's not really true anymore because, like you said, we've had quite an erosion in our teaching corps here in the state of Wisconsin, and finding good qualified teachers of any language will be a struggle.
Last 30 seconds, and not really fair to wait until now to ask this question, but we're running out of time. What is one thing that needs to be done that would improve language education in the state of Wisconsin?
Well, I think that we really need to change the thinking in our state that world language is not an extra, that it is a vital part of every student's academic programming, and it needs to start in kindergarten.
Okay. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Lynn Neitzel, for being my guest this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It was wonderful being here.
Lynn Neitzel is Director of Curriculum and Assessment at Blackhawk Technical College and past president of the Wisconsin Association of Foreign Language Teachers. This hour of programming was produced by Cynthia Schuster, and we had on-air production from Robin Cherry and also from Dave Potratz. Thanks to both of them. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.